Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. We have a bit of a birthday celebration here, my own birthday, and for what I bought for myself for my 46th birthday, a amazing album. I didn't even know it existed until I came across it. Had I known about it earlier, I would have gotten it then, but happened to find Dan Gurney and his World of Racing with Dynamic Sounds on location from Times Grand Prix at Riverside, 1960. 64, the Motor Trend 500 from 1965, plus ambient sounds of his Lotus Ford Indianapolis car, his Ford GT Le Mans racer, Brabham Climax, and Daytona Coupe. Again, this gem, 5 years before I was born, is when this came out, and I'm just smiling like a big old idiot at how awesome it is to have this record. Produced back in 65, and it is Dan talking about life and dimes back then. A lot of it is scripted, some of it isn't. There's a dyno session in particular where he just has some great kind of off-the-cuff remarks. So between the racing sounds, his commentary, some of what he has to say about a variety of topics, a professional announcer as well that you'll hear from time to time, ripping around the shop on a go-kart to you name it. This is just, I'm so happy I found this. And I bought it for myself because I deserve it. And then it was also really cool to close here to see in the back there's some special acknowledgments thanking Competition Press, magazine from back then. San Francisco's just the city, received a special acknowledgment. And my client, my friend, my family at Road and Track. So here is 1965, Dan Gurney and his World of Racing, and this is my little personal celebration.
Hi, welcome to my World of Racing. That was the sound of my Woods brother, 65, during my two laps of qualifying for the Riverside 500 stock car race. You can hear it during almost an entire lap. One of the greatest thrills ever to a race driver and his crew is a moment like this.
Another brand new track record has just been set. On the first lap, by Dan Gurney, in car number 121, a time of 133.50. 133.50, an average speed on this 2.7-mile course, 9 turns, of 103.957 miles per hour.
Soft-spoken Dan Gurney is one of the most popular international racing stars in the sport today. Yet he gives one the impression that being a celebrity and all the prominence that goes with it are of little importance. Dan's first and only love is racing. His intense inner drive for competition, steady nerve, the superior skills are his trademark and his way of life. The incidentals that go hand in hand with success and prestige have been good to Dan Gurney. But he has never lost sight of his one main goal: racing perfection, and perhaps one day a World Grand Prix Championship. If experience and background have anything to do with developing a capable driver, then Dan Gurney can go to the head of the class. His varied activities in racing include everything from go-karts to motorcycles to stock cars, Indianapolis cars and the Grand Prix cars. You name it, and Dan has driven it. As a teenager in Southern California, Dan was the typical speed enthusiast, racing motorcycles and hot rods, increasing his appetite for the future that lay ahead. In 1955, he gathered together enough money to buy his first sports car, a second-hand Triumph, and entered a California Sports Car Club race at Torrey Pines and finished third. That was the start. A promising young driver named Dan Gurney was beginning to grab attention.
I sold my Triumph and finished 2 years of amateur competition with a Porsche. I didn't know how I was going to become a full-time professional racing driver, but I did know I was going to do it somehow. In most professions, If you have skill and determination and you win enough, someone will help you.
Well, Dan did have friends in the right ones, too, like car owners Frank Arciero and Luigi Canetti, who were instrumental in giving him his first opportunities in Europe. These opportunities finally resulted in a berth on the factory Ferrari team. After running in front during his first four international sports car endurance races for Ferrari at Sebring, Florida, Targa Florio, Sicily, Nürburgring, Germany, and Le Mans, France, Commendatore Ferrari decided it was time to give Dan his first Formula One Grand Prix drive at Reims, France. In his second Grand Prix race at Avis in Berlin, he finished second. He was third in his third Grand Prix in Lisbon, Portugal, and fourth in his fourth at Monza, Italy.
As you can see, at that rate, I should have won my first race, and I've been getting worse ever since.
At the end of 59, Dan felt he needed experience more than anything else. And at that time, a Ferrari driver was allowed to drive only Ferraris. He just couldn't drive in enough races under these terms. So he decided to accept an offer from the BRM Grand Prix team. This move brought a lot of experience, including a brake failure that caused his most serious accident, plus a season that was filled with flashes of brilliance but virtually no finishes at all. The following year found Dan with still another racing team, Porsche of Germany. He had decided that all this jumping to a new team each year created many problems in itself, and he was going to stay with Porsche unless the factory burned down.
Well, the factory didn't burn down, but Porsche management did finally decide to pull out of racing at just about the time they were hitting their full stride.
Dan tied with Stirling Moss for third place in the World Grand Prix Drivers' Championship points after finishing every GP race without trouble in 61. And Dan managed to win both his and Porsche's first Grand Prix at Rouen, France in 62. In the meantime, Dan was battling away in many other types and brands of cars at tracks all over the United States, Argentina, Australia, and New Zealand. He left an impressive trail of lap records, but he was still trying to shake off finishing troubles at home. Here is the sound of the 1960 Times Sports Car Grand Prix at Riverside, where Dan is having it out with Stirling Moss.
Turn two with Billy Cross in the second spot. It is Dan Gurney first into turn two, followed by Stirling Moss, and then Billy Cross in the third spot as the whole field goes off rapidly around turn two. Take it away on turn six. Dan Gurney, the leader through the S's like you'd never believe, in a Lotus Monte Carlo right behind him in an identical car, Stirling Moss. Behind them, Billy Cross in the birdcage, Maserati car number 53. And let me tell you, those cars are moving. Car number three is next.
The world of racing is made up of so many things that I find it difficult to know where to begin. Why do men race? I surely don't know, but they do. Automobile competition on the international level gives me, the same added meaning that an athlete must feel while representing his homeland in the Olympics. Grand Prix racing is the pitting of all the strength and resources of the men behind the car, the tires, the engine, spark plugs, ignition, the steel, the aluminum, the blood and sweat of men that come from many, many of a nation's industries, against others, perhaps from other lands, other ideologies, who have worked just as hard and long, testing, planning, designing, spying, scheming, inventing, and hoping that their efforts will bring a victory. It's almost like a war without guns. One of the things that makes a win so sweet is that it comes so seldom. If you really get down to it, you realize that a race is won by one car and one car only. That means that there are dozens of drivers and crews at each race who find it just a bit difficult to come up with a smile. Usually they have worked for weeks, months, years, midnight oil, meals on the go, wives who are partial strangers, nerves worn thin, pocketbooks full of moths. They live and breathe racing almost day and night in hope of putting together the winning combination for a big one. Winning, winners, the victor. The magic words that have been sought throughout the ages by so many to be gained by so very few. I feel that this must be what makes a winner feel so fantastically elated as he gains the most elusive of goals. All the people on the team are just as totally happy as the man behind the wheel, as they also are standing on the same pinnacle when the checkered flag falls. Most members of a consistently winning team feel that winning isn't everything. It's just the only thing.
Dan's ability has broken through mechanical adversities many times for important victories and key performances. Among those early achievements included his win at the Daytona 3-hour endurance race, where he cranked the car across the line with the starter while a broken connecting rod hung out of the side of the engine. He had two consecutive wins at Nassau in 1960 and 61. He also shared the winner's circle with Stirling Moss after the 1,000-kilometer race at Nürburgring in the fog and rain, where an oil hose blew off their birdcage Maserati. Dan noticed the oil pressure gauge in time to limp back to the pits on a very light throttle to get a new hose and more oil. It must have taken 6 or 7 minutes, but they went on to win. In the end, the engine wasn't damaged at all. In 1964, Dan Gurney scored one of the most satisfying wins of his fast-rising career. Teaming with fellow Southern Californian Bob Bondurant, the pair came up with one of the international shockers by gunning a Carroll Shelby Cobra Coupe to a stunning GT Championship win over the fabled Ferraris in the 24-hour of Le Mans.
You seldom have a car that performs perfectly throughout an entire race. Mechanical difficulty is part of every driver's life. Often, we have very little trouble in practice, but on race day, the roof falls in. For instance, several times I have run 800 to 900 miles of Goodyear tire tests at lap record speeds without a hitch in the same car that lasts less than 20 laps during an important race.
Underlying Dan's racing desire is a drive to improve the sport for the ultimate benefit of all drivers, car builders, and fans. Pioneering new developments or just trying to be the first to do something new and different, Dan is very much a nonconformist. But he has a strong desire to see more understanding and respect among the many different factions in racing. Dan was the first person to bring an American stock car over to race on British road circuits, and they loved it. He was also on hand in Europe during the revolution in car design, which saw the British rear-engine GP car render the front-engine GP car obsolete. He was soon forming a plan in his mind which would eventually shake the American racing scene to its foundations. In 1962, he went to Colin Chapman of Lotus in England and laid out his plan. Soon, Mr. Chapman and Dan were visiting Ford Motor Company in Detroit, and the final result, as you can probably guess, was another major revolution. The Ford Lotus burst onto the scene. The old days were gone forever. As car technology advances, so does recording technology. Let's go back for a moment and relive some of the excitement of the 1964 Times Grand Prix for sports cars at Riverside. Here we go now, utilizing a new microphone system imported from Germany.
We have all kinds of engines in sports car racing. The first one that you'll hear on the back chute is a Buick. The second is the Ford that actually won the race. The third car is a four-cylinder Coventry Climax Grand Prix engine, like the one that Jack Brabham used to win the World Championship in 1959 and 60. I think the fourth one is a Chevy, and from then on, your guess is as good as mine.
Thank you.
Gurney prefers not to prognosticate too far into the future. When asked how he envisions the racing cars 10 years from now, he prefers instead to predict that the entire world will be competing under the same formula. And that's good for the United States as well as racing.
One of the things that has kept the United States out of Grand Prix racing is the fact that the World Governing Body, or the FIA, and our own U.S. governing associations have not been able to agree upon a common set of rules and specifications to limit such things as the size of engines and the weight of cars. Thus, we have ended up racing under different rules. I'm not saying that one formula is better than the other, but if we are all using the same fundamental rules, I think that racing people and fans alike would benefit tremendously. Someday, I think it will happen, possibly within the next 3 years.
To say that Dan is pleased, even elated, over the formula change to take effect in Europe in 1966 would be an understatement. Even though the crowds have generally increased, there is always room for more, and for more exciting races. Dan feels that the 1.5-liter cars run rather uninteresting races.
To my way of thinking, the present Grand Prix cars are just too small and they don't make enough noise. However, beginning in 1966, the Grand Prix rules will allow engine sizes up to 3 liters, or exactly twice as large. That means they should really sound terrifying. This new formula should be the one that sees the USA and the rest of the world competing in the same races, I hope.
The next few years are to hold some tremendously exciting racing contests, and Dan plans to be right in the thick of them. For a preview of some of the racing machines themselves, let's visit with Dan at Riverside International Raceway.
In the background, you can hear my Ford stock car warming up for a demonstration pass, along with several other racing cars, including an Indy Ford Lotus, several assorted Cobras, and a Grand Prix car. Here comes the Indy car now. Next is the sound of the car that recently won the International 2,000-kilometer endurance race at Daytona, the Ford GT. This one is a Shelby American Daytona Coupe. Here's a 427 Cobra Roadster. I like this next one. It's a Cobra set up for drag racing. Listen to the way it gets through the gears. This is one of those little quiet 1.5-liter cars I mentioned, a Brabham Climax V8. I guess they still sound kind of nice at around 10,000 RPM, Here, we're testing on a little one-mile road circuit using just a portion of the track at Riverside. We have the track divided up into four sections with electric eye timers for each section. This is one good way to measure the performance of new tire designs and rubber compounds. Actually brake using the heel and toe technique, braking with the ball of my foot and working the accelerator at the same time with the outside edge of my foot by bending my ankle slightly. This way a driver can rev the engine up to the right speed for engaging the gear that he needs to exit the corner with as much power as possible.
For his sports car racing, Dan has a Ford-powered Lotus that he is continually preparing for the season. Let's visit Carroll Shelby's shop in Los Angeles, California, for a listen to Dan's engine during a dynamometer run.
Okay, let's fire it up. A few details while it's warming up. The dynamometer is just an engine test stand with some sort of an adjustable brake which can apply various loads to an engine. By applying these loads to a scale, we can see how many pounds of force the engine can exert in trying to turn this brake. By combining pounds of force and a given RPM, we can compute the horsepower of the engine at that particular speed. This engine is the same one that powered our sports car at the Daytona 2000 kilometer race where we led for 8 hours. It flew. It is a hopped up Ford 289, the engine that powers Mustangs, Fairlanes, and Cobras. In its most powerful standard form, it puts out 271 horsepower. This one is ours. It puts out a maximum of 445 horsepower at approximately 7,000 RPM. Racing factories all over the world. The engine seems to have a life of its own. The engineers that design and build them sometimes treat them as though they do. Since they mother them from the embryo stages when it begins with the first pencil line on a piece of drafting paper, through the stages of the first time raw steel feels the bite of a machine tool, to the final assembly, and then to the dynamometer where it can first be heard, no wonder that they feel it has a life of its own. It certainly has a voice. Sometimes it's like a prehistoric monster crying out into the jungle from its cage in the test house. Thank you. but with the door open. It's really loud. You really need to wear earmuffs. Building up in stages to around 7,500 RPM, which is the highest. Just like your Fairlane, doesn't it? No wonder it blew up after 8 hours. That monster really wants out of his cage. Hungry. Things about the dyno. It's an indispensable tool for engine development work. By changing or modifying one thing at a time, such as carburation or fuel injection settings, or valve sizes and shapes, or camshafts, or cylinder head designs, or pistons, or other things of interest, you can see if it improves the performance or not. From the safety standpoint, a driver is not so apt to be injured if the engine breaks on the dyno, and also it doesn't wear out the racing car. Let's have one more blast on this same engine with a different exhaust system. See if you can hear the difference.
Temperatures there, Jack? 106.
106.
72.
72.
93.
93.
305.
3015.
15? Okay.
Then out things, Daniel.
Dan's world is racing, and he loves it all. Here is Dan and some of his friends running a go-kart around the shop. Can blow out the cobwebs on occasions as well. Gurney has chosen racing as his future, and it's a sure thing that he would do it all over again if he were given the chance. You see it in his eyes when he settles down into his car before a big race. You can feel it in his voice whenever he speaks on the subject he loves. And you can be sure of it by his example of determination and skill on the race course.
Naturally, it's not as easy as it may appear to some people. But if I had the chance, I'd do it again and try not to make the same mistakes the second time around. I've been fortunate to have the opportunity to make a good living for my family and a chance to show them many parts of the world. And I hope that in some small way, I am making a significant contribution to racing.
It's been a long way up for Dan Gurney since he followed the racing exploits of his boyhood idol, Ted Tappan. But he's made it to the international circuit and is making his mark on the sport he loves. This is Sandy Reed speaking to you from the control room of Mobile Fidelity Records in Los Angeles, California, with one last word of advice. If the neighbors have complained of hearing the sounds of a race course next door, invite them over. Let them share with you Dan Gurney's World of Racing.
And that was Dan Gurney and his World of Racing. What a delight. All right, Big Eagle, you still have 39 laps on me. The big man's 85 this year. I'll tell you what, of my probably 3,000 records, I think this might have just shot to number one of all-time favorites. I hope you enjoyed. This is just pure whimsy. It's not an interview. It's not racing sound that I made. It's just a crazy old record from an out-of-print label that I'm so glad I found and bought, and I hope you enjoyed it, and I'm gonna go do something cool for my birthday. So, as always, thanks again for listening. Check out more podcasts and other content at marshallpruitt.com.